Number two, which is Columbia River Fishery Management Policy. So this is a briefing and a workshop. And Bill, I will turn it over to you. Your name was first on the list, Bill, so I don't know. I don't know.
Senior.
Directors, my name is Bill Twite, and I'm a special assistant in the fish program with the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife. This morning's presentation is as a two-state panel discussion, and so have the other panelists introduce themselves to you, and then we'll dive into the presentation if that's your pleasure at this point.
Good morning. I'm Ryan Lothrop. I'm the Columbia River Policy Coordinator. I work for Bill up in the Olympia office, but travel down to the Ridgefield area quite a bit for on a weekly basis.
Good morning. Chris Kern, Deputy Fish Division Administrator with the Columbia Marine Programs for ODFW.
Tucker Jones, Ocean Salmon and Columbia River Program Manager for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. Little side anecdote, I just think it's interesting to note that about 20 years ago, coming up in December, I stood in this room as the best man for my best friend when he got married here. So,
are they still married?
Yeah. No.
Commissioner Bad Smith, karma. That was the wrong question.
Bad karma.
Never ask a question.
Or don't want to hear it.
So we have a multi-part discussion this morning. So I wanted to orient you to the different parts that we were going to cover, and we'll be switching around back and forth between staff. But I want to emphasize that overall the presentation has been a joint effort. Even though we're on individual parts of it, this is something that, as is typical of all the technical work that we do, all the analytical work we do, products get shared back and forth across the river. The workload gets divvied up often, and we've always have the chance to review and comment on each other's work. And much of our work is actually produced under joint letterhead. In this case, not all the parts are actually on sort of joint letterhead, but we've all had an opportunity to provide input on each other's work. So with that, Ryan, do you want to sort of walk us through exactly how the agenda is going to go?
Yes, so we're going to first start off with the timeline, so the review process between the two states' policies, which Oregon will walk us through that. Then I'll take over and walk through our Washington policies review for the last 5 years. This is a very similar presentation and information provided to the Washington Commission 2 weeks ago. And then we'll kick it back over to Oregon to walk us through concurrency and thermal sanctuaries, and then on to next steps.
Thanks, Ryan. In the packet, I believe everybody received, there's a document entitled Oregon-Washington Commission Review Timeline and Concurrency. Most of what I'm speaking to is on the first page. It was a little large to put in the PowerPoint, so that's why we provided a hard copy instead. That timeline just lays out the dates and activities of the two commissions for the last couple of years, particularly starting at the end of the transition period, which ended in 2016. And you'll see that both commissions began reviewing that transition period at that point, late 2016 as planned, and that there's a lot of similarities in those timelines from then on. Speaking of the Oregon side, we began the comprehensive review for the transition period in November of 2016 and had additional analyses and follow-up discussions at the commission in December, January, March of 2017. And based on that review, the Oregon Commission adopted some rule modifications in March of 2017, which remain in effect today. And as the commission guided staff, we have been providing annual updates every year, and so we continued that in March of 2018, summarizing 2017 fisheries. The Washington Commission also adopted some policy revisions in January of 2017, as I understand it, with some additional discussions in March. And those included the extension of the transition period approaches for the fall seasons for 2017 and 18, with a requirement for a comprehensive review at the end of 2018. And as Ryan mentioned, Washington staff have been conducting that review with check-ins with your commission and the public, and also presented that summary at October 15th. And that sort of brings us to today, November 1st, joint meeting, and that's what I had for the timeline to set it up and turn it over back to Ryan or Bill.
So I'll be walking through our five-year, and by our, I mean Washington, excuse me, Fish and Wildlife Commission policy review. So we've had quite a bit of staff dedicated to this review. We've worked alongside with Oregon and data requests and reviewing of analyses they have to assist us with our process. But so we'd like to say thanks on the support there and all the staff that's assisted Bill and myself along the way in reporting back to the commission and the public. So I'm going to walk through a brief background on this five-year policy review, or what led up to the five-year policy review. The timeline, so when it initiated, what got us to where we are today, the commission briefings that have occurred over the last essentially 8 to 9 months, and then the public outreach that we've incorporated into this policy review, and then really the nuts and bolts of this presentation will be actually reporting out on each of the major sections of the policy review. And then there'll be a summary, and then on to next steps. So the Columbia River Fishery Management Work Group developed strategies in 2012, and the Washington policy adopted their policy in 2013, relying upon and dependent upon some of the work that occurred with the work group. It was amended in 2017 and is currently in effect through 2023. As mentioned from Commissioner McIsaac, there are three primary objectives: orderly fisheries, conservation recovery of salmon steelhead, the economic well-being of the and stability of both the sport and commercial fisheries. There is recognition that information will change over time, and so we have adaptive management, and that the overarching principle behind this policy was to establish recreational priority for salmon and steelhead in the main stem. So I mentioned that this started about eight or nine months ago. It came from a request back in January in the form of 40 questions from the Fish and Wildlife Commission to determine how the five-year review, how 5 years of the policy has performed. We've since then, through just last month, have had both commission presentations and fish committee briefings with the commissioners. In both cases, those meetings were open to the public, and we, had some added emphasis into some questions, some analyses that we've conducted, some feedback on our analysis, and to better produce this report. And we've also reached out with our both commercial and recreational Columbia River advisory groups that we co-manage with Oregon staff. And so we had those primarily in Ridgefield, but we also had one Eastside public meeting that we garnered some additional information from over in the Tri-Cities area. So during this entire process, we provided information on our both advisory group websites, as well as the commission website, and directed people to those sources as these draft versions of the review report were developed. So I mentioned we had 40 questions. Well, a lot of these questions had some similar themes, so we recategorized these into seven overarching themes. You have management, recreation, commercial, tribal, allocation, alternative gear, and economics. As I walk through the rest of this presentation, which is the actual evaluation itself, you'll notice that we aren't listing out individual questions on this, more or less categorizing them into policy strategies. And some questions were, you know, less significant for the success of the policy, so they may not be contained in here, but these are the large principles that we're reporting today on. And so looking at this, we also have SCORE up there as kind of a metric, and so you can swap that out with implemented. And looking at red, you can swap that out between meaning no or not implemented or did not occur. Yellow means mixed or partially implemented, and green would mean yes or implemented or did occur. So the first strategy was conservation. Before I jump into that, it's important to note that one of the purposes of the policy was to advance conservation recovery of salmon steelhead, focusing on and promoting recovery of ESA populations, the agency leadership and recovery actions, including hydro and meeting the terms of USV Oregon. The policy has built-in conservation benefits based on the Columbia River Management Agreement under USV Oregon and the associated biological opinion. In short, these conservation efforts that are ongoing outside of the policy, we are meeting those objectives. However, the policy does have an added question regarding are we meeting objectives for PHAS, so proportional hatchery fish on the spawning grounds, and reducing those numbers, primarily on Falchnook and Coho. And so these were dependent upon increased marked selective fisheries. As you can see there, we have red category, so it's not been successful in the sense that these reductions did not occur as expected. There was an overall slight reduction in PHAS, but those are primarily attributed to weirs, removing hatchery fish. So moving on to marked selective fisheries, these occur, and this was a little bit tied into the previous question, they occurred at low levels. It gets a red category there due to the low level of occurrence in the sense that they were infrequent or not powerful in the sense of fully implemented marked selective fisheries. And the next strategy was predation. And similar to conservation, there's a lot of work ongoing outside of the policy itself, such as marine mammals and northern pike minnow reward program. WDFW authority on much of the predation, we do not have the authority. However, there is progress in some of those sectors, so it gets kind of a mixed category or a yellow score. The next item is concurrency. Much of our allocations with Oregon are similar or identical. However, there are several situations where they are not the same. I won't get into too much details because we're going to bring that up after this presentation. For example, there are differences in the fall Chinook allocation between the commercial and sport fisheries. Staff also provided a synopsis, which is in your packet, of challenges that arise from not being concurrent, which can lead to challenges for staff in planning fisheries, harvesting available fish, and enforcing of regulations. The last item there, management tools, what that pertains to is using metrics or technology or other forms for staff to improve their ability to, for example, develop forecasts or manage their data sets or run reconstruction development. That's work that we staff on both sides of the river are always striving to improve on. So that is ongoing, and we're always moving forward on that one. So moving forward into the recreational theme, we have 3 points here: recreational priority, barbless hooks, and logbooks. Recreational fisheries were prioritized across all fisheries during the pre-season planning process, and that is due to the allocation changes. Barbless hooks were implemented within most areas, and there are some exceptions where there are low ESA impacts in tributaries. And the last item there, logbooks. Washington does have the authority, and background on that one is collecting information from the guide industry on, you know, how many trips or what they're catching or encountering. And so that work, Washington does have the authority to enact that regulation for the guide industry. However, it has not occurred yet. And there are ongoing discussions on what that may look like. And I believe that's will be brought up later on today in the discussion in more detail. So the commercial theme here, you have your MSC certifications. That's marketing for sustainable fisheries for the commercial industry. You also have buyback, increased Washington safe or select areas. And then another question is if we monitored the 2017 commercial fishery in the main stem. So with the MSC certification, this was not reviewed or pursued during the five-year policy. Certification costs were expensive. However, it was reviewed back in 2008 to 2009 that led to those being aware of the high costs. There are other avenues to improve marketing that are probably cheaper, but we focused in on MSC certification on this analysis. And then buyback, essentially nothing has occurred. It has started, stopped, and has since then this year has restarted with stakeholders. So that's why it gets a red score. And then the new Washington safe areas. Washington, we haven't had any success. We've pursued work in the Cathlamet Channel, had very low survival, have conducted test fisheries and has deemed not to be successful. There have been improvements on the Oregon side, however. And the last item there is monitoring the 2017 fishery in zones 4 and 5 for the commercial gillnet fishery. That did occur last year, and with similar results as expected. For example, the handle of steelhead was low and similar to what preseason expectations were. However, we did also note that Chinook harvest was less than expected. One thing I may have omitted when I started off is this is a five-year review, and so that would imply 2013 through 2017 are the years we are reviewing for this policy. So in some cases, we are looking back at pre-policy years, so that just for background information, that's 2010 through 2012. So sorry, I forgot to mention that earlier today. So moving on to the tribal theme, we have the Colville allocation and Wampum subsistence. Those of you who aren't familiar with those tribes, they are non-treaty tribes, not part of USV Oregon. We have state statute to provide opportunity for fishing with those tribes. And so in both cases, we're providing those with Colvilles primarily for summer fisheries, and Wampum has harvest opportunities for summer and fall Chinook, a little bit of spring Chinook, and sockeye as well. And those are located interior Columbia River within the state of Washington. And then USV Oregon tribes, that was a question we actually did not receive from the commission, but because this is a tribal theme, we thought it was relevant to include USV Oregon tribes and show that we are meeting the allocation objective obligations that are in standing with the USV Oregon. So moving forward on to allocation. Washington policy allocates ESA impacts. In reviewing whether the preseason impact proportions match the postseason impact proportion is not always best to view that as success. Staff does show ESA allocation sharing in our full report. However, we're focused a little more on proportion of allocated catch. And so in this review, we're looking at between the sectors, commercial and sport, as well as geography between upriver and downriver. In-season management can have effects on what this, how this plays out, you know, when the run is updated, whether it's increased or decreased when fisheries occur. So that's just something to note. But overall, across all species, recreational and commercial fisheries harvest a higher proportion of their allocations. So in a sense, we are meeting the obligation, the, what is prescribed in the policy for allocation. To note, with spring Chinook, we use catch balance, and that is more constraining than the ESA impacts. Within the sport sector, we have approximately a five-year average of 88% for sport attaining their share, and then commercial is 95%. Within sport, you can see it's a yellow category, and that's referring to above Bonneville. Below Bonneville, doing quite well and meeting a high majority of their catch balance, but above Bonneville between zone six, so that's Oregon-Washington border downstream to Bonneville, and then the Snake River. Those are more variable on years based on, you know, run sizes, timing, water conditions. So on all average, though, they do use up a majority of their allocation, but it does vary quite a bit from year to year.
And when we've missed the allocation, at least in one year, we missed it big time, essentially granting almost no fishing time to the upriver. And so, again, that's part of the reason why it's shown as yellow is these aren't, as Ryan mentioned, these aren't, at least a couple of the years, they haven't been small misses. They've been big misses in terms of allocation.
Thanks, Bill. So with summer, between the sport and commercial, they both average about 84 to 85% of their share being used. Below Bonneville's, below Priest Rapids Dam, so that's PRD, Priest Rapids Dam, 87% is used. Above is 69%. However, to note that 69% for fisheries above Priest Rapids, they have a full season still available and ongoing. Moving forward to the fall fisheries for Tules and Brights, in both cases for commercial and sport, greater than 90% are used for both Brights and Tules. So in essence, a high proportion of allocated catch are used by all fisheries. So moving forward into the alternative gear section of the report, the 4 points here, have gill nets been phased out? Did alternative gear testing occur? What's the performance look like for alternative gear? And has alternative gear been implemented? So the first strategy on phasing out gill nets has mostly occurred within the Washington policy as prescribed. So that means both spring and summer have been phased out since 2017, but fall has been extended, so they have not been phased out. Moving on to the alternative gear testing, there has been quite a workload conducted by staff in primarily focusing on beach and purse seine testing, including looking at mortality rates. Ongoing, there is a pound net study going on, started in 2017 and ongoing this year in Cathlamet Channel. So moving on to the actual gear performance, there's quite a few items I'll kind of walk through briefly here. But so the first one, and this is why it pertains to kind of mixed results or mixed performance. So we've had issues with higher mortality rate on salmon like Chinook and Coho in the seines than you would anticipate, making it challenging to implement catch needs due to ESA impacts. Steelhead, handle, shad, and sockeye can be quite high in primarily small mesh like the seine gear. And then the biggest challenge has just been the sheer high handle of steelhead in some areas. Even though there's a low mortality rate associated with it, the numbers add up, and in a sense you would use up your steelhead impacts quicker using those fisheries and have a less Chinook value take home for the commercial sector than the gill nets. So, and just to reiterate that, that's mostly due to a high number of encounters of steelhead, not the actual mortality rate associated with steelhead. And then a couple other points. Switching over to purse seines, for example, or pound net do involve a high investment cost to get going. For purse seines, it's a slightly different business structure. You need a crew rather than an individual fisherman. So those are additional challenges. And the last item, I'm talking about coho tangle nets. They do work. Their mortality rate is pretty fair. They don't occur every year. They need a high volume of fish to be successful. So that's the challenge with coho tangle nets. So moving forward into implementation, Washington does have statute to allow new gear to be phased in and tested through our RCW emerging fisheries statute. There's been a very few alternative gears put in place, beach seine and purse seines in particular, occurring during the fall fisheries. There have been ongoing during certain years coho tangle net fisheries as well. So there have been low levels of alternative gear being put in place. I guess to note, the purse seine and beach seine fisheries that were put in place were limited entry, so that limited participation potentially. Or the other aspect on that is the investment cost may have hindered full participation. So the other note here, I also have a spring Chinook tangle nets were successfully developed and have been used since 2003, but through the Washington policy are no longer available as of 2017 in the main stem. So take-home message here is alternative gear implementation did not occur as you would have expected with the development of the policy. So I'm moving into the last theme, so economics, kind of your the take-home big message here. So these are the expectations in the sense from the work group. To allow the policies to succeed, you would want to have the sport fishery increase opportunity and angler trips and days of fishing, enhance safe areas for commercial fishing, and implement the alternative gear. All these would have to occur in order to enhance economics of both sport and commercial fisheries. One aspect that was a challenge in analyzing and evaluating this aspect of the policy review was the effect of run size. So that's just to make sure you're aware that it is an effect that does directly impact the economic value for both commercial and recreational fisheries. So just here we have upriver spring Chinook. The actual run size during the 5 year was approximately 192,000 upriver spring Chinook. Through the work group development, it was expected we'd have 225,000 fish returning. To know, angler trips are highly correlated with the upriver run size for spring Chinook. And fall Chinook, the actual run size, as you may remember, was quite a bit larger than we would have expected, more than two times greater. The average run size during the policy was nearly 970,000 fish, compared to an expected of 475,000 coming back. This helps explain why ex-vessel value on the main stem were high for fall Chinook, just large numbers to catch, and the average price per pound held high for this fishery. Also to note, summer, I don't have a graph on summer Chinook, but it was slightly above expected, but pretty close to what was expected by the work group. So moving on into the economics report card, recreational fisheries under enhancements did see an increase in days and open and angler trips. However, they were marginal, and they're also primarily due to the large fall run sizes, of which I mentioned more than two times greater return on average. Ex-vessel value in the commercial fisheries were negative in four of the years of this policy review. When the run size and price per pound were adjusted, the difference between what was expected and what actually occurred were negative. And then within SAFE, SAFE did increase, primarily in Oregon. Production did increase as well. And on the Washington side, did not succeed there. And all in all, the increase in SAFE did not make up for the loss of mainstem gill net fishing opportunities. And then the last point there, alternative gear fisheries occurred much less than anticipated, mostly due, as I mentioned, to the disproportionate steelhead usage for ESA impacts, among the other limitations I talked about. So kind of coming back to SAFE areas, as I mentioned, they did expand in Oregon. We looked at Cathlamet and did not succeed. Washington side, we do not have any new areas. Though Oregon did explore, and Coal Creek is on that list to explore. We do have our water quality challenges, you know, high temperatures in the summer with that, and, which is attributed in the low DO to survival. So when we've been test fishing, like for spring snook and Cathlamet, fish just don't survive. We only catch a handful of fish each year on the test, on that test fishery. Also to mention, we looked at participation of Washington fishers in the Oregon SAFE areas, and they're relatively low at 16%. And from what we've heard, those are primarily due to decreased cost effectiveness, so basically ability to make a profit to go into the Oregon SAFE areas, and also heard that there perhaps is a lack of room to fish. And then the last item there is adaptive management, which we did employ in 2016 and 17, so revisions to the policy moving forward. So the take-home message here is the enhanced SAFE and alternative gear implementation use did not replace the reduced gill net opportunities. Recreational fisheries did see an increase in days of opportunity open and angler days, but were marginal and not to the expected level that was provided in the development of the policy. So I'm moving on to kind of conclusion with the summary. This has been a very prescriptive policy. Many of the intentions of the policy were not realized or achieved. However, the take-home message here is that the expectations in that development of this policy were not met. To note, most conservation predation work is ongoing, but outside of this policy. And with that in mind, the additional conservation benefits of this policy have been relatively low. All sectors were able to use the majority of their allocations, so the lack of success of the policy is not due to the opportunity as prescribed by the policy on shares of fish for harvest or impact. In the sense of economics primarily, alternative gear development did not find a replacement for the mainstem gill net fishery, with development still continuing today. The policy allowed gill nets to be extended in the mainstem part, in part because alternative gear development and implementation did not find a solution yet, and that has yet to change. Additionally, the SAFE fisheries primarily benefited Oregon fishers. Production has increased in recent years, but did not materialize the fisheries, as there have continued to be survival challenges. And the allocation shift from a commercial to recreational has only provided a slight increase to trips and catch for the sport fishery, all while still not meeting the expectations that were set in the development of this policy. So what is around the corner for us? Well, in 2 days, Bill and myself will be back in front of the Washington Commission to hopefully work on finalizing our five-year report, as well as discuss what the next steps are and ideas we've heard from the public, as well as ideas from commissioners. And so that kind of leads us into this list. These are common themes of ideas that we heard through our 8-month public process on this policy review, as well as ideas from our commissioners. We did not provide any analysis or evaluations on these ideas, but just kind of give you a sense of what these ideas are. And I believe they're actually in your packet. And also to mention, that packet included our executive summary that comes out of our five-year report. So we heard everything from do not change the policy, let it stay as is, to basically start over. Also negotiate concurrency with Oregon or see how it plays out in 2019. Also moving on to allocations, we definitely heard some discussions from our east side representatives on this sport allocation between above and below Bonneville, basically, and focused a little bit more on the Snake River. So there's been a lot of push to consider looking at ways to provide more opportunities upriver. Also, changes in sport and commercial allocation, and we also heard ideas on bringing back the Spring Chinook Matrix. There's been ideas on continuing to pursue logbooks for the guide industry. Consider making barbless hooks voluntary. Make the commercial license buyback path continue forth and provide funding and allow it to succeed and make sure it occurs. Also hire an expert to assist with alternative gear development and implementation. Allow for spring Chinook tangle nets within the Washington policy. Continue, this kind of comes back to where we are at the first point of allow the policy to play out. So continue the ban of commercial or gill nets within the main stem fall fish, within the main stem, or end that gill net ban. Also consider the economic value to smaller communities. And so what that also means, coastal communities that have depended for years on commercial industry down there. The dollar can go pretty far. As well as we've also heard the same argument for our upriver constituents around the Snake River, that a dollar can travel further in a local, smaller community than it can in Portland, for example, and Vancouver. Also, continue work on safe area enhancement in Washington and include the commercial industry in those developments. And lastly, have more interface with conservation efforts, primarily focusing on working with our recovery boards. So that's the policy in a nutshell. There's 200-page report draft version you can find online if you have some extra time on hand to review. But again, that's why we provided you the executive summary, so you can kind of get the gist of what we learned over the last 8 months on how the policy played out over the last 5 years. Bill, is there anything else you'd like to add? So I'll move forward on to the next aspect of the presentation.
Unless commissioners have questions at this point.
And I'll open that up for any discussion at this point.
I have a question.
Yes.
I was trying to follow in your presentation the pound nets. And I guess I missed the overall conclusion, or whether there was success, limited success, or failure.
So far, we're still in the middle of evaluating, so we're not ready to tell you whether it's either success or failure. From a conservation perspective, the initial results are promising, but we're still waiting for final peer review on the calculated release rates and all that. But the draft release rates, the mortality rates look good as well. This fall we conducted, based on those preliminary promising results, we went ahead and conducted an economic evaluation of the gear this fall during the fall Chinook and coho fishery. And again, numbers are just starting to come in right now. What we were hearing on the spot was that just from the condition of the fish, the buyer that we were working with was able to market them into a fairly high sort of high price niche because the fish were in very good condition, very desirable on the market. What we don't know yet is whether there was sufficient volume to go with that sort of promising pricing structure. And then the coho return was so poor, we essentially couldn't really evaluate economic viability in terms of the coho fishery. So stay tuned.
Okay, thank you.
Chair Finley, if I may.
Yes.
We've been involved also with the Pound Network, not as intensely as the Washington Group, but certainly we've provided some financial report and been engaged with both the commercial fishermen and the wild, who is Wild Fish Conservancy, I believe, who's operating it. And I would say that the Pound Net is a mix of things that look great and things that are challenging. It is a pretty large infrastructure to put into place, 40-plus piles, so lots of permitting and other costs associated with hanging that. On the flip side, it catches fish, so and the fish that it releases seem to be in very good shape, but still, I mean, as we know from all of the all-gear work that we've conducted, there are two pieces, right? Can it catch fish, and can it release those fish that are not the target fish safely? And so that piece is still outstanding, and really before you can settle on economic feasibility, you have to bring that whole package home.
Does it look the way the pilings and set that there's durability, that they're not at risk, that there's a long-term period to amortize the cost versus the benefit?
Yes, the existing pilings have been in place for at least 5 years now, and they've held up well. So,
thank you.
Just remind everybody, when you do ask a question, please use your mics. I was informed. Commissioner Thornburn, you had a question?
That you mentioned with the Pound Net. My recollection when Wild Fish Conservancy presented to us, they had done immediate mortality studies, and there was some talk about doing later mortality in the next year. Have those been distinguished or looked at?
I'll give two answers. First off, is there is always a very positive and strong correlation between immediate and long-term. So even though you can't always necessarily generate the number for long-term off of immediate, if you get a very good immediate, we can predict also a very good long-term. Yes, we are currently cooperating with Wild Fish Conservancy and the commercial fishermen to try to find additional funding for some additional testing, focused more on the spring than the summer, fall. But there are plans to continue to try to test, and if we can get the funding, do both long-term and immediate.
Commissioner Carpenter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you address what I would consider a value-added component as it relates to the harvested fish in the Pound Net because of the ability for the fishermen to bleed and gut and high-grade those fish, how much by percentage it increases the marketability of those fish? And has there been any, a second part is the question, has there been any discussions with the commercial industry about co-op ventures into the future if the Pound Net opportunity appears to be viable?
Thank you, Commissioner. On your latter question about discussion about co-ops, no, not we've not had any formal discussion at all. We've certainly all had some ad hoc hallway discussions, but the department has not undertaken anything formal, and I think on either side of the river about that. In terms of the marketability, at this point, everything we have is still sort of informal assessment. We don't have a rigorous assessment of that yet, but certainly the indications from the buyer we were working with is that indeed these fish have the potential, because of the different handling, these fish have the potential for at least some portion of the total catch to go into a higher market value category. Sort of similar to what the in Washington State the reef nets were able to do quite a few years ago, and they've been able to maintain their price differential. So it does stand to reason that the observations we're getting off the Pound Net may well turn out to be similar to that sort of price boost or that market boost that the reef net fish get.
If I may, I'm not trying to add to your workload, but if we could in 2018 do a comprehensive analysis of that. The value-added component on quality fish like that has some significant opportunities. I'd like to know more about it probably end of this season.
You won't be adding to our workload. That is already part of what we...
I'm sorry, I got it right.
We do intend to address that.
Thank you. Thank you.
Commissioner Woolley.
Mr. Chair. So you mentioned the cost of alternative gear as a barrier to successful implementation. We have some of those same challenges in Oregon. We did legislate a fund for the commercial fishing businesses. It kind of operates sort of like a grant-making fund. And so we're wondering, if Washington had a similar program for your commercial anglers.
We don't have a program that's comparable. In past legislative sessions, the legislature has provided funds, and we don't have it at present, but much of the development work we've done has been through sort of specifically targeted funding from the Washington legislature in past years in order to promote development of these, but there isn't a fund comparable to the Oregon Fund.
And another quick question, if I may. And I know you've been intending to regulate the guide industry logbooks, and I know that's on your in your policy. I'm just wondering what the challenges have been to get that going.
Part of the challenge has been, for us, has been just a sequencing, at least from the Washington perspective. This isn't something that we view as just a Columbia River problem. We've been discussing this with the guide industry statewide, and so we're beginning to take those steps more on a statewide basis, but that's been part of it. It's just been scaling it up to statewide. And then the other part that we still need to put some thought into is in the lower Columbia, for us, it's not just guides, but actually under Washington rules, only charter boats may operate below the Longview Bridge and then guides upstream of the Longview Bridge. So whatever we work out in the Columbia will need to be something that's workable for both charter operations as well as guide operations.
Thank you.
Mr. Grable.
Again, on the topic of alternative gears, I believe on your alternative gear report card page, there is a purse seiner shown there, and I believe that's the Colville Tribal purse seine, which is a very small boat that has very high success with extremely low mortalities. I believe, Bill, you've told me that the testing that was done on the Lower Columbia was done by similar boats. I'd like to see that supported. I'm not convinced that we couldn't operate boats like that for PHAS relief, particularly with tules. And I also am curious to know if the pound net that we're observing that's operating now is quite substantial, and I'm wondering if a scaled-down version or a similar version couldn't be positioned near the hatcheries where we have these extreme PHAS problems to find relief through that effort. That's just an open question that we can follow up on later.
Okay. Commissioner McKay?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On slide 16 under economics, you talk about the expectations that were to occur at the onset of the policy, and for the recreational fishery, that there was an expectation that due to reallocation, there would be increased angler trips and days on the water. And then a little bit later in the report, after you've taken into account smaller run sizes, which might have driven angler trips down, and larger run sizes, which may have driven angler trips up, regardless of the policy, that you give a yellow to increased angler trips, and you say that recreational fisheries have only seen marginal benefits in terms of, I presume, angler trips. So two questions. One is, did you do any chi-square or statistical testing to determine whether these marginal increases are statistically significant from zero? And what was expected at the onset in terms of an increase in angler trips or angler days? Was it a substantial increase, or was it only expected to be marginal?
While Ryan is looking up the answer to the latter, no, we didn't do any actual chi-square tests on that, but it's pretty obvious to us, given the fairly large amount of variability within that limited five-year data set, that nothing would have been significant at either the 90 or 95% level.
And Mr. Chairman, I don't want to delay the meeting. Okay. If we're looking up for a particular number of 22 or 19 or something like that.
Mr. Atkinson.
More of a broad question.
I'm sorry. We're ready.
I was wondering when will the policy update be voted on? And I guess my interest is, because the two states are looking to try to come closer to concurrency, it seems like Oregon is also going to need to be working in that same kind of time frame.
Commissioner, on Saturday, so the second day of the Washington-only meeting here, we will be presenting the full five-year review, including the modifications that were requested by our commissioners when they saw the five-year review at the previous meeting. And we will be presenting it to them as a vote on whether or not to accept that as the final. Then we understand that the commission may also at that point be ready to begin to take a look at that list of potential next steps, but we're guessing that probably a full next steps discussion won't be able to occur until after our commissioners have had time to really digest that list of next steps, even though I think they've all heard many of them at previous meetings. This is the first time they've really seen the compiled list, and so as a staffer, guessing what my commission's going to do in 2 days, I would guess that they may decide to agenda that discussion on next steps for one of the next few meetings.
Okay. And so the next steps you were referring to, is that list of potential changes to improve the policy?
That's correct.
Okay. Well, I'm eager to work with Washington as well to see if we can jointly figure out how we can improve this policy.
Commissioner Buckmaster, were you trying? Okay.
Thank you. On your page 19 economics report card, under SAFE, you mentioned that it expanded areas. You gave it a yellow, said that Oregon expanded areas. Just for all of our information, maybe Oregon could address what areas were actually expanded on the select areas.
Let me chip in, the Commissioner Buckmaster. Let me check and see if John has that information handy. Where is John? Are you in the very back? Certainly, we examined expanded time and area for fisheries. We definitely have expanded those opportunities in the winter. They provide small but high-value access to fish for those spring chinook fisheries, those early fisheries. Still examining whether or not a new area is on the docket. As far as expanding boundaries, difficult to push out too far without jeopardizing the allocations that are around.
So for Washington staff's purposes,
what I heard was there are no expanded areas. We have expanded some time within
yes,
the
also,
existing areas.
Also expanded into the summer, so those late spring fisheries, which have still been providing access to primarily late returning spring chinook.
In the existing areas?
Yes, correct. Within the existing areas.
Okay. So there's been no expanded area in Oregon either, but we have expanded some time, which I appreciate. Okay, thank you.
Commissioner, we'll note that.
Yes, Commissioner Thornburg.
Quick follow-up question that I noticed in looking at the materials that you provided from Oregon. Related to this, I think you have a Young's Bay control zone sport closure. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Because isn't that related to your question, Commissioner Buckmaster?
Sure, I'll take a shot at it, Commissioner Thorburn. So the history on the Young's Bay closure zone, as I understand it, it predates my time here a little bit, at least in this position, but came up during the work group discussions, I believe, back in 2012. And not to get in too far into the technicalities and weeds, but Oregon's legislature, as part of, I think Commissioner Woolley had mentioned, some of the funding things that came through legislatively, during that statutory process, there was also an inclusion of the control zone there, which put some requirements on implementing it and also reviewing it after a certain period of time. And I can't remember the effective date, so I'd have to look that up, but and so that came through that, and then as we reviewed the policy a couple of times, there was discussion of whether to keep that or not, and it has remained in effect since then. It was part of the discussion point is encounters of fish destined for the Young's Bay commercial fishery and sport fishery that transit through that specific area, and trying to, I think the intent was to try and reduce some of the catch rates in that bubble as those fish transited into the select area.
Just to kind of follow up, so the future of that, it sounds like there's a statutory issue, or what's the thinking of the commission? And
Commissioner, I wouldn't speak for our commission, but the statutory link was specifically to establishing it by a date certain and with a directive to the commission to review by another date certain. The continuance or not, I believe, was left to the discretion of the commission.
I see.
To resolve after that point. So the statutory part, I believe, is has basically served its time, and now it's a commission decision.
I see. Okay, thank you.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you go to the management report card slide? I think it's slide 10. And I appreciate that it's difficult. There's a lot of information here, but there are a lot of nuances, certainly, and so I don't take this as a criticism, but it's hard to kind of put everything red, yellow, green, and so. And that leads me to my question or clarification as far as conservation is concerned. I mean, I think if you just came in off the street and you saw, wow, we're not making our conservation objectives here. But I think I heard Ryan say that that's not the case. That at least pre-policy, certainly, USV Oregon has still has a lot of conservation objectives. Of course, we have ESA that we work with our friends at NOAA to make sure that we meet those objectives. So, maybe comment: Are we achieving those objectives outside of the policy? And then the follow-up question to that would be, what specifically are we talking about in terms of the red for conservation under the policy?
Yes, thank you, Commissioner Kehoe. We are meeting our objectives outside the policy and conservation objectives established pre-policy, such as ESA objectives through USV Oregon. That's probably one of the largest conservation items that we manage, in season with fisheries, or meeting our ESA take on, say, Snake River Wildfall Chinook and, or upriver spring chinook. So year in, year out, we are meeting those objectives, sharing obviously resources with our co-managers. So the question that this pertained to, that the reason it's red is we were focused in on PHAS analysis. So to further clarify what you asked and what you stated and what I mentioned before, is we were focusing on, did the policy through marked selective fisheries reduce hatchery fish returning to the spawning grounds? And so, yes, there's always some benefit. Obviously, we're catching hatchery fish in marked selective fisheries, so you are reducing them, but they weren't significant, in, especially comparing to what the weirs are able to, even challenges with weirs that operate every year with high flows and everything else in between. Those primarily hatchery fish removal was occurring through weirs and removing hatchery fish. So that's why it's a red score.
Okay. And may I, just a follow-up, just to, and then if you look at the, I just want to make sure that I'm clear on this. The gillnet phase out under the alternative gear report card, that's a yellow, and of course, and we know that, you know, it's because we modified the policy 2 years ago, actually right here in this room or maybe down the hallway. So I just want to make sure that the gillnet, the failure to gillnet, the failure to phase out gillnets in the river is not a reflection of the failure to meet the conservation objectives or conservation. That's not why it's marked red, correct?
Correct. It's just, yeah. So the phase out was just, it's a yellow, as you stated, because gillnets were extended through this year even.
Okay. And then just one last, Mr. Chair, slide 13, the tribal report card. We have all green there. And there is a little asterisk provided prior to the policy. So I guess my question is would Washington and Oregon meet these objectives if this policy was not in place?
Yes, so we would meet objectives for both the Colville, Wanapum, and USV Oregon tribes, external of the policy, whether it was included or not included.
Okay. And I'm sorry, just one last follow-up. I want to follow up on Commissioner McIsaac, then I'm done, I promise. Commissioner McIsaac, I thought, brought up a good point as far as statistical significance in terms of improvement or increase in recreational angler trips. I would pose the same question with respect to the PHAS, you know, small reduction in PHAS. Was there any look to see analysis whether that small reduction was statistically significant? Now I'm done.
We can't disentangle the amount of the reduction that was due to alternative gear from the amount of reduction that was due to the installation and use of the weirs. Overall, though, the reduction itself, even though, again, we didn't test for significance, it was present every year. There was a clear reduction every year and reasonably consistent numbers. So it's always hard to get statistical significance out of 5 years, but it was a clear and consistent result. But as best we can determine just from the numbers themselves, just the raw numbers that went into it, the vast majority of that was due to the weirs. And let me just add to that, but staff are very aware that if we're going to achieve our goals for reducing PHAS, we can't rely just on weirs. I think Ryan made that clear, that over these 5 years, the weirs worked well, but we know they're not going to work well every year in all situations in all rivers. And so a multi-tool approach to managing PHAS over the long term, to successfully managing PHAS over the long term, is essential. And we get that the ability to use fisheries, both recreational and commercial, to remove large numbers of hatchery fish is going to be a very important part of a long-term successful program to manage the proportion of hatchery strays. So don't read into this that we feel like we've got success just because the weirs worked pretty well over the 5 years that we reviewed. That's exactly what we're saying, yes.
Commissioner Carpenter, McIsaac, and then Commissioner Buckmaster, and then Commissioner Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This relates to, as a follow-up to Bob, he's going to let me get a question in now, but as it relates to the conservation piece, you know, it looks like on many of the runs in the Columbia River, everything is cyclical. We had big peaks, and now the peaks are reducing over some years going forward. I've been reading quite a bit lately, and I'm not expecting an answer today on this. Maybe you want to actually think about it, but I've been reading quite a bit lately about what's expected as it relates to some level of El Nino that's involved in our coastal habitats upcoming, and there's also another blob that's forming, and it's worrisome. It's very, very worrisome as we go forward. Maybe you want to think about it and give us this afternoon, if possible, some type of a strategic plan that might be able to evolve into some type of a strategy going forward.
Commissioner, well, I think staffs are planning on huddling up over lunch, and we'll see if we can provide you some with preliminary thoughts on how we might approach that later on.
Question for staff, but a response or a follow-up from Commissioner Atkinson's question about where do we go from here. I'd been hoping that after we hear the full staff presentation that there might be a lengthy discussion here at the front table about what do we do about concurrency in 2019 in particular, but maybe in the long run as well. And I am not anticipating that we would have any discussion of particular ideas, but rather just the process. And I presume that we would need to get ideally to some concurrency for 2019 early in the year. The North of Falcon process starts up pretty early, and so the discussion around this table for me might be what can we do to try to jointly get together early in the year for a thorough discussion of concurrency that does get into some ideas, not today but later, and then what about a process for the longer term? But I've been holding back and looking forward to that discussion after the staff presentation.
Commissioner Buckmaster.
Thank you, Chair. I don't think my comment is really that important to those of us who have been involved in this issue for a long, long time, some from the beginning. But I think it is important for the general public. I noticed we have some reporters in the audience, and so I think words do matter. On page 7, on your background, you say designed to establish recreational priority for salmon and steelhead in the mainstream Columbia River. For somebody who wasn't aware of pre-plan allocations, that would indicate there wasn't a recreational priority before this plan. It would also suggest that somehow there was a steelhead, some sort of priority, or I think equal between commercial and sports, where we know it's always been recreational on steelhead, at least in the last several years. So for purposes of just clarity moving forward, it seems like this was a plan that was designed to increase the recreational priority. And I don't think it changes your color coding at all, but it certainly changes where we started from. And I think it might be more informative to those casual readers of what we produce, what you produce. Thanks.
I had a question about the PHAS. During which season is the PHAS of greatest concern?
Throughout the basin, it is a concern for most runs. This policy focused on the use of fisheries to help achieve PHAS objectives for Lower Columbia Falls Chinook, ESA-listed Lower Columbia Falls Chinook, and ESA-listed Columbia River Coho.
Do you want to add anything to that?
Okay.
Okay. And so that's primarily because we're not able to harvest all of those hatchery fish?
There's a balance. So both National Marine Fisheries Service and on the Washington side, the Lower Columbia Salmon Recovery Board, and I can't speak to on the Oregon side, but they've all those entities have identified large numbers of hatchery origin, both Chinook and Coho, on the spawning grounds as one of the primary threats, one of the primary problems to achieving our recovery objectives for those fish. And to go back to basics, there's two ways of addressing that. One is reducing hatchery production, or the other is more efficiently and effectively removing the hatchery fish on return. The reason that both the agencies and recovery boards and others have been reluctant to take reducing hatchery fish as the only tool is because of the importance of those hatchery fish both to ocean fisheries, really for both states, as well as to in-river fisheries. And so the attempt has been to really balance hatchery production with the appropriate range of harvest tools as well as weirs in order to achieve those objectives. And that's what we're still working towards, is finding that right balance and finding the tools to actually successfully and consistently achieve that balance.
Okay. And so what happens to the excess hatchery fish that are at the weirs?
Again,
most of the weirs are in Washington.
Yeah, on the Washington side, there's most of them, because the weirs are located fairly near the hatcheries, and upstream of most of the fisheries, except some of the tributary recreational fishing. Most of them are simply removed for surplus. There may be other uses at times, such as carcass supplementation, but I think the bulk of them are simply removed and surplused.
And what does surplus mean?
Sent out for hopefully for some amount of commercial sale in order to simply remove the fish from the watershed. So usually bought by a buyer, and they essentially then go into low grade, at that point low grade salmon usage. But again, where we work out alternative arrangements where we can to get the highest and best use, but it's always a challenge for us.
Okay, thanks.
Are we ready to continue on? Yes.
Brian, you raised an issue I haven't heard much about as we've gone through this process, and that is, I think you said that at least in Washington there was a limited entry system for tangle nets and seines. What I'm wondering is possibly a bit more general than that. Are Washington and Oregon in concurrence with respect to, speaking from the commercial side, who can buy licenses and who can't?
That's going to require both states to answer. Chris, if you want to start.
If I could ask a clarifying question, are you asking, does Oregon have limited entry on commercial permits as well?
Correct.
Yes. Yes, we do.
One of the factors that's been sort of stymieing buyback, though, is because each state does license separately, and because even when there's limited entry, there's still often licenses for sale. Trying to ensure that joint goals, such as the license buyback program, can be met, or joint limited entry goals can be met, requires a degree of coordination that isn't currently available to us legally, but could be designed, but hasn't been necessary yet, but will be, I think, necessary if we're to achieve those goals.
Also, Commissioner Baker, one more clarifier. So while the licenses in general are limited entry. The tangle net fisheries, once you have a license, are not limited entry. The same fishery in that experimental way was additionally limited entry from the pool of license holders. Those fisheries were implemented under research impacts, so we had a limited amount of ability to fish there and could not turn that open to all commercial license holders at that time. So that was, limited entry within the limited entry.
Commissioner Grable, why don't you wind this part up, and then we'll take a 10-minute break and then continue on with the presentation.
All right. Briefly, I wanted to point out on the conservation scorecard, the way I read it, and with closer reading of the review, I think it would be fair to say that one of the reasons that this scorecard is low on conservation is A, because of USV Oregon, we were meeting conservation goals. And unless there was real significant improvement due to the policy, it would be difficult to move the bar. Closely reading the review, you will see that it is mentioned that there was conservation benefits in the spring run, and I believe one other, maybe it would have been in the fall. I don't have that in front of me, Ryan, but I think you recall that. So there was benefit, and it would have to have been very significant to move this into a yellow or green area due to already imposed very strict ESA benefits from USV Oregon. So I think that's fair to say. And another just brief comment is that under new mark selective fisheries, no, we weren't able to expand safe areas. And we weren't in the lower Columbia River Basin able to make much progress during this period, exact period. However, I did want to mention in the upper Columbia, in the region that I live in, we had several, just within Region 2, at least four, probably as high as six, additional mark selective fisheries that became available during this policy period due to escapement. So I just wanted to make that mention, and then I'm done.
Thank you. I think we'll, with that point, take a 10-minute break and then continue on with the presentation. So it's 10:27, so 10 minutes from now. Come back to order, please. We won't start without you, Bill. But now we'll start with you there. So please continue, gentlemen.
Chair Smith and Finley, members of both commissions, again, my name is Tucker Jones, Ocean Salmon Columbia River Program Manager for Oregon Fish and Wildlife. I'm going to walk us through a little bit of where we are regarding concurrency. I believe you guys actually have this. It sort of breaks down a little bit small on the screen, so if you want to work through your own handouts, that might be best. I guess a little housekeeping road mapping for these slides. Spring, summer, fall, look at Coho. Those issues where states are sort of not in alignment are bolded within the matrix. So just, I guess, as a way to orient yourself. Thinking with regards to spring, really I think more in common than not within spring Chinook management between the two states. Allocations are similar. No pre-update buffer applied to the commercial off-channel fisheries. where we differ is sort of what can occur in the main stem post-run update. The Oregon policy allows post-run update for tangle nets to be used in the main stem to access any unused commercial allocation. And at that point, so those are things that would not happen typically very often, but and would probably occur only on an increasing run update. So if you forecast a certain number and then the return at the update is more, then you would potentially have a chance to access those through tangle nets in the main stem, according to the Oregon policy. The Washington policy, as it currently stands, does not allow that. So, you know, we're concurrent on allocation, we're concurrent on the buffer. We're not concurrent on whether or not there can be main stem commercial fishing post-run update. And then, again, I guess on the Oregon side, there is a provision that unused commercial impacts are left for escapement, and the Washington policy does not speak to that, in my understanding. Moving to summer, again, largely concurrent with regards to summer fisheries management. We are definitely concurrent on allocation, 80-20 sport and commercial. No gear net gears allowed in the main stem. There is the option available in both states for commercial main stem fisheries, but without a gill net provision. The difference in the summer between the two states is what is to be done with any unused commercial allocation, and they're sort of partially different here. The Oregon policy states that any unused commercial impacts, or not impacts, I guess, unused portions of the harvest allocation, because they're not listed in the summer, are to be left for escapement and conservation. And in Washington, that is a potential option, but they can also be transferred to upriver sport fisheries. Fall is a little messier, I guess, with regards to concurrence between the two states. Right now, Oregon has a, and that's, I guess, partially due to the fact that fall is just messier from a fisheries management standpoint with multiple constraining stocks in the river at the same time. And so the splits in Oregon on allocation are basically less than or equal to 70% for sports of the most constraining stock as forecasted in the preseason, and greater than or equal to 30 for commercial. Washington, those splits for 17 and 18 are 75-25, and then moving forward would be 80-20. In the Oregon policy, gill nets are allowed in commercial zones 4 and 5, which is, I mean, I'm sure you all know, but upstream of the Lewis River Warrior Rock line up to Bonneville Dam. That is the same for Washington in 2017 and 18, but as currently written, would be phased out moving forward. And then the Oregon policy also allows up to 2% of the commercial allocation to be available to alternative gears in the lower river for those sort of PHAS reduction type fisheries. So concurrent, I guess, on gears currently, but not necessarily on allocations within the last couple of years, and then moving forward, not concurrent on either allocations or gears to be used in the main stem. Coho, everything is concurrent. Non-gill nets in the main stem, tangle net fisheries only. Assign the commercial as a sufficient share of the impact to implement both off-channel and these single net fisheries. Same in Washington. Everything is concurrent here. The trouble here is that there's been it's been difficult to access these fisheries in the last couple of years. So moving into the concurrency summary, sort of trying to step through this relatively quickly. I guess to start with, there's nothing about, you know, co-management or concurrency or the compact process that impinges upon state sovereignty. You know, concurrency promotes orderly, enforceable fisheries and increases the likelihoods of allocations being achieved, but it's not required, and each state can do what they need to. That being said, not having concurrent regulations is a real tough situation from a management standpoint. It's going to impact fisheries pretty substantially, both recreational and commercial fisheries. Certainly a higher impact for boat-based fisheries. You know, anything land-based would just be following the sort of, as it does now, I guess, the regulations of the bank you're standing on, but would have a pretty high impact on those boat fisheries. And we'll make it very, very difficult. I mean, the border is pretty well set on a map, right? But the map is harder to find when you're on a boat on the water and things move. So that will make it difficult for us to manage. It will make it difficult for law enforcement to enforce. It will make it difficult for our customers, the anglers and commercial fishermen, to figure out what they're going to be doing and how they're going to be doing it in a way that fits within the bounds of what they want to do. So not really a place that I personally want to be. And then I guess I just want to touch briefly on the fact that, so these are sort of broad overarching concerns about concurrency, but the states and the staffs on sort of the minor nuts and bolts things, we already work together periodically to try to chew up things and work together. And in fact, we're working on sort of a reg simplification process right now. We've met a couple times and are talking about sort of chewing up the small things. It's these sort of larger overarching issues that are more troublesome. So next slide, Brad. Thanks. Briefly talk about thermal sanctuaries and thermal concurrency. I don't know how much this is on the Washington Commission's radar, given that I haven't come to a Washington Commission meeting in a while or ever. So
you're invited.
Well, thank you.
You can look at the materials on the website. Yeah.
And Bill will sign the.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. I appreciate that. This is an emerging issue. I think everybody is aware of climate change and how that's impacting our world. It was really thrust to the forefront of our world in 2015 with really hot weather, low precipitation, really just uncomfortable river conditions for fish coming back and for fish leaving. And, you know, the states took some actions then in response to that. And then sort of not too long after that, in 17, and again this last year, we've had really sort of low returns of steelhead, summer steelhead destined for interior basins, Snake River especially. And we took a lot of management actions to sort of reduce the impact of fisheries on those summer steelhead. Those were not primarily, you know, looking at these sort of thermal sanctuaries. I guess also concurrent to this, the EPA has begun looking and examining the importance of cold water refuge areas throughout the Columbia River. And so that's an alternative process going on, and I'll speak a little bit more to that next slide, but I just also want to say, without going into too much onto it because I'm not that intimately familiar, that there's been some recent litigation and a decision in the federal courts with regards to the temperature TMDL in the Columbia River system, and that's going to throw another wrinkle into this whole process. So, next slide, please. So, as I said, the EPA has been working on identifying both areas and use of these areas by fish migrating through the Columbia River corridor. This is an ongoing process. Originally, they thought they were going to have a draft report out late summer, early fall, around the end of August or September. It's my understanding that they now expect that draft report out in December or early January. Again, hard to know how the recent litigation may throw a wrinkle into that. we have sort of committed within Oregon with working with the EPA and the public and sort of identifying these areas and examining situations. So examining boundaries that could work to try to protect these areas during those migration corridors, but also in situations when you might want to employ them, both temperature-wise and run size-wise. It's a pretty complicated thing to try to actually figure out. The focus for this thermal sanctuary work that we've been engaged on is primarily upstream of Bonneville Dam. To really have an effective area, you need to have temperature differentiation. So if the temperature's not enough different, right, so you need to have a cold water input and a warm water out thing to really sort of attract the fish. And most of those seem to be upstream of Bonneville. There are lots of other places downstream. The differentials are not as much, but there are 13, I think, identified primary cold water refuge areas by the EPA, and I think 7 of those are on the North Shore and 6 are on the South. We'll work once the EPA gets that draft report out to put boundaries on those and then talk with our public about, do these boundaries make sense? How do they look? Do they make sense biologically? Do they make sense from a fisheries management standpoint? Do they make sense from an enforcement standpoint? We did do a little bit of that work this summer, putting in a thermal sanctuary area around the mouth of the Deschutes. It was tricky from a management standpoint to try to find that right balance of biologically meaningful management-wise, recognizable by the angling community and enforceable by law enforcement. I think we were sort of narrowing in on that in an adaptive management sort of way, but right, I think when we were finally getting that dialed in, we sort of realized that the Steelhead Run was not materializing as we expected, and we basically quit fishing on it, which sort of negated the need really for the thermal sanctuaries in the fall. And at the same time, temperature differentials also came down to the point where we weren't really looking at enough of a difference between the river and the main stem to have that same effect. So, again, we're going to be working through this, and we have been in conversations with Washington staff as we go. I know they are also, I think, at least professionally curious, and also, if you know, I don't like to put words in the mouths of my counterparts, but I know they're engaged and think that this has a potential importance as well.
Mr. Grable.
You know, this came to Oregon last year. I appreciated the action that Oregon took off the mouth of the Deschutes. And we closed Drano Lake, maybe, I think, for the same concerns, particularly for the steelhead, although that does get some mixed docks, and we're going to talk about that later in our meetings as well. How far upstream did the investigation occur in terms of looking for these sanctuaries?
So the Deschutes is about as far upstream as you can get and still have that cold water differential. Those sort of inputs further upstream, John Day, Umatilla on the Oregon side, Yakima, what's the Rock Creek, I think, they're not cold enough,
right,
to provide the differential between there to attract the fish. The other thing I think that's important to think about with these thermal sanctuary areas is that they can be important and useful for steelhead because of steelhead's life history, yeah. Right? They have a longer clock. For sockeye, summer chinook, and fall chinook, these are largely hospice areas, and if those fish go there, they will probably wind up dying before they reach their interior basin. So,
okay. Let me just add a little bit to Tucker's final point there, because I think that's a very good point worth remembering. And that goes back then to the issue of whether or not EPA, and then I guess in cooperation with the states, is actually going to do a TMDL for temperature throughout the Columbia system. And that will get at, so for instance, that gigantic loss of sockeye that we had in 2015, that had little or nothing to do with the availability of thermal refugia in certain spots. It had everything to do with the ambient water temperatures as they move through the system. And so it's keeping both of those in mind. As Tucker mentioned at the beginning, the recent decision on TMDL is another sort of complicating factor in a way, but simply from the perspective of trying to understand thermal refugia and trying to think of them as a management tool, it is a complicating factor. Ultimately, over time, I think, and this is probably where Tucker was going with this, that being able to address both ambient temperatures throughout the main stem as well as thermal refugia is probably going to give us the biggest sort of bang for fish protection in general.
Yeah. And one of the wrinkles I meant by the recent litigation is that I don't know what that will do within the EPA with regards to their staff and their work on this area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, neither do we. And it strains our resources as well, but it,
yes, Commissioner McIsaac.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A question on the EPA study. So analyzing the effects of a closure can be a complicated manner, as you've indicated, and it would be comforting to know that the kind of sophistication in fishery management analysis that's at the table here and each agency is involved in that. If an area, say, off the mouth of the Deschutes is closed, obviously then anglers will not be there. There'll be fewer steelhead hooked and released in that refugia area. But there'll be greater effort outside, and some of the fish that are saved from inside will be hooked and released outside at different water temperatures that are higher. And so it all gets very complicated and does require some level of sophistication to come up with an answer of whether or not these refugia result in more steelhead on the spawning grounds than if the refugia was not in place. So it would be disappointing if the EPA report came out and just said cold water is good for fish and didn't get into whether or not the refugia as a protection, as a fishery management tool, actually does accomplish something significant. So my question is, are you all involved in the EPA study, and can you bring that, your expertise and sophistication, to that forum?
Chair Smith, Commissioner McIsaac. Involved in that we are working and engaged with them, but not involved. They've been actually not really inviting into sort of their modeling workshops or any piece like that. And I expect that their study is going to be probably slightly more than cold water is important to fish. It will be identifying the areas where they are and is there enough cold water area for the fish that are migrating through the system. I'm going to go ahead and pretend I heard another question in there and answer it anyways. With regards to the management aspects of that and recognizing a difference, and if you can model out the effort shifts and the catch differences that will occur there, I think those are really difficult questions, and it's going to be very hard to, I think, discern whether or not these are actually resulting in an increase of fish on spawning grounds. But, you know, it is a increasingly hostile climactic environment for fish moving through the system. And sort of applying the precautionary approach is what we would be doing here. So you're not necessarily sure the magnitude of the benefit that you're applying, but that you're trying to err on the side of the fish and the resource.
Tucker, do you know what office within EPA is tasked with this?
I don't know which office is actually. I know who my contacts there are, but I can look into finding that out.
Thank you.
If I could add, they do have a website that discusses quite a bit of their process, so I think that would be pretty easily accessible as well.
Were you done? Okay. Yes. Okay. Commissioner Atkinson, yes.
I have some questions about the thermal sanctuary information. In looking at this EPA map, and I know this is still the draft phase, why is Oregon interested in only focusing above Bonneville Dam? It seems like there are some important refugia potentials below Bonneville Dam, in particular the Sandy River.
Largely a focus of where we think the impact would be the most effective, Commissioner Atkinson.
So even though we have a fall fishery in the lower river on Chinook, and the lower river is even hotter than the upper river, why not?
There is certainly a larger effort focus within these areas upstream of the dam. Downstream effort is spread out a little bit more. I mean, it can also bunch up around the mouths, but is not nearly as concentrated as it is upstream.
So do you have fisheries information about the use of these potential thermal refugia at those river tributaries?
More anecdotal, we've just recently started applying our creel methods upstream of Bonneville Dam.
I'll briefly add to that one thing that's very different below Bonneville from upstream is the effect of the tidal wedge, and that's typically pretty cool water. And, you know, the fish are getting once or twice a day. The fish can always find downstream of the Cowlitz, really, and upstream of the Cowlitz can often find several times a day. And trying to sort that out from everything else and from when fish are more and less catchable relative to both the tidal cycle and all that it's a much more complicated situation for us to try to figure out whether there's a role there. And we just have not seen the kinds of mortalities or losses below Bonneville, and again, probably in part due to the presence of the tidal wedge that we've seen upstream. It's upstream where we've got clear evidence of thermal problems, both in terms of refugia, but equally in terms of the ambient temperatures. We weren't seeing sockeye mortalities, for instance, until well upstream of Bonneville in 2015.
And Chair Finley and Commissioner Atkinson, that's not to say that they're off the table. They're right. Just not the focus.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. And it sounds like there is some significant information from the Idaho research that had 3,000 radio telemeter fish that were monitored on what they did and didn't do relative to using thermal refugia. So I guess we have some information from that as well, as far as location.
They tend to hopscotch their way up.
Mm-hmm. And the other question I had was, is there any reason that we need to wait for the EPA study to set up rules for the 2019 year regarding thermal refugia?
Chair Finley, Commissioner Atkinson, I think that it is, in my opinion, you can certainly take management action, but we do with the best available science all the time. At this point in time, it feels like there is going to be an update to that best available science and that it is right around the corner. And I don't think that there's anything that stops us from taking management actions in 2019 if required. And I expect that this process will continue and we will move into the public thing. But as far as permanent rulemaking, I would much prefer to get that complete body of work in hand and have it to consult and look at and use and then take those actions, then to take some actions and then have an update to the best available science and need to reopen those and readdress. I mean, you may not have to. You might not have to. We might have got it right. I am pretty awesome, so there's a chance I could get it right out of the gate. There's a chance I could get it right out of the gates, but sometimes I don't get it right, and staff, sometimes we miss a little bit, and I think when that information is on the cusp of being in our hands, doesn't seem to make a ton of sense to make a big action on a permanent scale until we have that in hand.
Well, thank you for being really awesome, and we do appreciate that. Just wondered about a timeline for when we might be addressing that.
So, Chair Finley, Commissioner Akinson, the original timeline involved working this fall. As you know, I talked to you guys in Baker, and that was under the assumption that the EPA was going to be handing us that report in late August, early September. I anticipate if we get that report in late December, early January, we will start moving. You know, the timeline had months on it for meetings and talking with the public and a commission action. I think sort of it is still in place, just the months are fluid at this moment. But certainly I expect sometime within 2019, unless something dramatic with regards to the TMDL litigation changes within the EPA.
Okay, so it could be before our 2019 hot water season that we could be implementing something?
Yes, it's definitely possible, Commissioner Akinson.
Mr. Buckmaster.
I think you will continue to get pressure from members of the Oregon Commission to have something in place for 2019. The EPA in Portland did a workshop on this issue, and just for information, both we had members, staff from both WDFW and ODFW at that workshop. So as far as having staff involved, at least at the one I attended, we had staff from both. So I have confidence that we have staff staying abreast of the issue. I learned things at that particular workshop. I was absolutely shocked that there was not a significant thermal striation by depth in the Columbia River. I just always assumed that you were going to have a lot of cold water at the bottom of a 40 or 32-foot channel. And what was presented at that workshop said that that simply isn't true, that there's enough mixing going on that you don't have that. The length of time that the various species stay in thermal refugio. I don't think there's anybody that would argue that if you're going to hook and release a steelhead in warm water or cold water one time, it's better to do it in cold water. But what was shown at that workshop, and we've received other information, is that unlike the Chinook, steelhead can stay in some of these refugia for up to 30 days. So it's a question of multiple hookings that concerned a number of us on the Oregon Commission. We talked about having at least the beginnings of a matrix based on time, based on temperature, something that did as little as possible to inconvenience fishermen in Drano Lake for sockeye or Chinook, but to protect. I think we're at a place where we feel a very serious concern and responsibility to protect the steelhead. Based on the numbers we've seen the last few years. So like my colleague from Eastern Oregon, I think we would like to see the best we can do, a reasonable sense of a matrix approach to where and how we're going to look at refugia, knowing full well that whatever comes out of the EPA in the lawsuit may change it with additional information. But I don't think we want to miss that opportunity, erring on the side of these steelhead runs is the right thing to do. I think our Oregon's, and I believe Washington, has said the same thing. So,
yes,
in fact, we have unanimous consent. We did a sense of the commission about these refugee issues, and not just in the Columbia. I mean, we have issues in the Umpqua and other streams too. So We have asked the department to develop an overall scheme that would have criteria to allow the director to implement closures, restrictions, or other actions necessary, and we think that's important.
Mr. McIsaac.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question goes back to concurrency, so if there's, I don't want to interrupt any theme on the cold water.
Yes.
So that we trust Tucker and Chris with your awesomeness that you will
he's just gotten it.
Put a very high scrutinizing eye on the analysis that the EPA does. And we know that you'll do that. My sense is that their conclusions and recommendations may be more conservative and less progressive and less conservation focused than ours would be. That's just my own personal opinion. And so we would hope that you would be poised to take those next steps that benefit fish and have that as the highest priority, because I think we may have a higher bar for conservation. So, you know, we look forward to you implementing that scrutiny in your work, okay? Yeah.
Yeah, Commissioner Woolley, as a former EPA person, I share your concern. Yes, Commissioner Keough.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm looking at this a little differently and wondering if staff have explored this along with NOAA. I'm very familiar with the Fraser sockeye management. I sit on the Fraser panel and have been there for a number of years now. And over my tenure, we have seen, of course, increasing temperatures in the Fraser River, and which no doubt lead to pre-spawn mortality. And so what the panel does, along with the Pacific Salmon Commission, is, you know, there's been a lot of work. It still needs to be fine-tuned, and there's some complicating factors. But in essence, what we do on the Fraser is that when we see warm temperatures above certain, 19 degrees Celsius or higher for Fraser sockeye, what we end up doing is increasing the escapement goals to compensate for pre-spawn mortality. And so this is it's a little different approach than the thermal sanctuary. So, but my question is, has that been explored to see if you can kind of quantify what the pre-spawn mortality loss would be associated with different range of temperatures and then compensate for that by increasing escapement goals? I know maybe a lot of people in the room don't want to hear this because it does, at least with respect to the Fraser, result in lower harvest. So I just put that out there and just curious if that's been explored.
It's an excellent point, I think, Commissioner Keough. I'm personally not aware of any detailed study of pre-spawn mortality of steelhead associated directly with different levels of temperature. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist. I'm just not familiar with it. And I suspect it may not exist at that level of detail yet. I know there's lots of pit tag comparisons made for pit tagged fish as they go upstream and survival rates between dams. So there is at least some ability to assess certain kinds of interdam loss and make some estimations of total loss. You have to account for a lot of variables, which should be at least conceptually feasible. Whether it's technically feasible, I don't know. And then the difficulty would be, is there enough variation across time in the temperature to be able to get a strong relationship between those things? So there's a couple of phases there, but I'm just not aware of it if it is done. On the non-treaty fishery side, you know, we're operating within a 2% ESA limitation, so we have some flexibility there. It's not a direct escapement goal-based process. And, of course, USV Oregon would have to be a part of that harvest rate schedule. But if the data was there to support that, it would be something worth discussing. That's about the best I could do, I think.
No, good. Thanks.
2015 was really our first year of experience with broad-scale pre-spawning mortality due to temperature outside of Steelhead, where we've got some longer history. But, I mean, as Chris said, we don't have that kind of fine-grained data even on Steelhead. But 2015 was a wake-up call to us in terms of the effects of temperature more broadly than just the cold water refugia issue. And I think we still have to grapple with some of those. And Chris accurately described the process we would need to go through. Chair Smith, I do have one. If before we move on to other concurrency issues, I do want to make a final point about concurrency and thermal refugia. But I'm fine to hold that until you...
Maybe Commissioner Carpenter's question will not take it from there.
I was reviewing the winter almanac, if you will, forecast for our part of the world. Washington, Oregon, Montana, it's supposed to be warmer. I don't recall if it's wetter or drier. That's not relevant. In my mind, it's the warmer part that concerns me as far as snowpack, et cetera. But my question is, you folks have been working together from both states. Has there been some consideration, because of the importance of this as it relates to Steelhead and other stocks, of forming a type of task force of people from both states and perhaps some stakeholders and to really drill down on this and build a coalition to find a pathway forward on this as quickly as possible? And if you haven't done that, maybe I could ask you to consider that and talk to your folks in each state agency and see what they think about that.
Commissioner Carpenter, speaking more broadly for the Steelhead issues in particular, or specific to thermal refuges, or sort of both together, all one? Okay, that's what I interpreted. I just wanted to clarify.
Yeah, it's a good idea.
I think it's an excellent idea, and you actually did get towards part of the point I wanted to make, only you generalized it more.
I'm not as good as Tucker, but I'm gaining.
He's awesome, too.
I mean, I don't want to cheapen the awesome label, but I would put you in the awesome category as well.
I think it's been cheapened already.
the specific point that I wanted to make that I think goes pretty directly in a lot of ways to Commissioner Carpenter's suggestion is that even when we're looking at, say, a cold water refugia that's in one state's waters of the concurrent waters, it's still a concurrent waters issue. It's still a two-state issue. If Washington's considering a cold water refugia on the Washington side of the river, but that it's still in concurrent waters, Oregon anglers need to know that. And most Oregon anglers don't go to the Washington pamphlet. They depend on the Oregon regulations to tell them what's going on throughout the concurrent waters, and similarly on the Washington side. And so even though, yes, it's quite possible for one state to act sort of unilaterally in order to protect a cold water refugia in response to a certain set of circumstances, it's very difficult for the other state to not also react in order to make sure that anglers are fully informed of any changes that happen anywhere within concurrent areas. So it's never just a one state. So the solution that Commissioner Carpenter just suggested is actually probably a really good way of making sure we're both moving together at every point, and that's what's going to serve anglers the best as well as meet conservation objectives the best.
And did you have further points that you wanted to?
Okay. No, sir.
So we can go to other questions. Have you wrapped up your... Then we'll just open it up for other questions. And I believe, Commissioner McIsaac, you had a question.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. With regard to concurrency on your slide 27, you made note of the fact that in Washington State there was an adaptive management response that changed the situation on Zone 4 and 5 gillnet fisheries. And the Commission, at least on one other occasion in Washington, has entertained the adaptive management provision for something that would be a change to the policy. My question is, I don't understand the Oregon adaptive management capabilities. I'm not aware that they have the same kind of policy document that gets into all of this detail of season by season, stock by stock, and the rest of it. But maybe I'm wrong. There is such a document. So my question is there an adaptive management feature in the Oregon analogous policy description of managing the Columbia River, and has it ever been exercised?
Commissioner McIsaac, yes. Oregon's approach is most of the policy aspects are actually written into administrative rule, including the allocations, gear requirements, and an adaptive management rule subsection within our OAR. So there is that. There's also some language in the statute that we referenced earlier that discusses adaptive management in the Commission policy. So it is absolutely front and center in the Commission's policy. And I would say, yes, the Commission has taken adaptive management. If I reference the process we went through last year in 2017, staff made some presentations for some adaptive measures, including not implementing the long-term approach that was in place or anticipated to take effect in 2017 for fall. And so I would say that was one example of adaptive management, and there are probably others as well. But yes, long and short, I think the answer is absolutely yes on both counts.
Mr. Baker.
I'm looking at slide 26. And just on the issue of non-concurrency, one of the lenses that at least I look at it through is that we can disagree on how we manage people and gear and that type of thing, and it's awkward and it's hard, but it can happen. But we can't disagree on how we manage fish, because fish don't listen to any of us. And so when we get to a non-concurrent issue like what we do with the unused commercial catch, which is down on 26, and it says for Oregon it's left for escapement, for Washington it's either left for escapement or transferred upstream. What happens on the ground when we have that kind of a disagreement? What if we want to go ahead and transfer the escapement upstream, and Oregon wants to just leave it for escapement?
Thanks, Commissioner. It's not an easy question, but at present, as Ryan pointed out when he talked about the upriver spring Chinook fishery, upriver summer Chinook fishery, excuse me, and their whether or not they were actually catching their full allocation, at present they're often not. And so those fish then do accrue on through to escapement. And the reason they're not is we've got a fairly complicated set of fisheries up there to try to help achieve our PHAS goals, as in addition to just the basic spawning escapement goals. So to some extent, we crimp their style in a way that if we weren't doing that, they'd obviously catch more fish. So at the practical effect of this difference at present is nil. Because that fishery isn't, that upriver fishery isn't taking its full share now. It's getting its full opportunity, but not taking its full share now. In the future, though, if and when that fishery does begin to take its full share, then that does pose a more complicated issue that ultimately I think the two sets of managers would need to resolve, but it also would include the Colville tribes. They have a significant voice in what happens to the non-treaty share of summer Chinook. And so I think in essence it would end up having to be a three-way discussion to resolve that. And we've just been able to avoid that discussion because of present circumstances.
I might add just a couple thoughts. I think Bill covered it well. In the summer case, for instance, you also have geographic differences, and so there is a point at which those fish migrate through concurrent waters. and go into waters that are solely within the state of Washington. And so, you know, where Oregon's role falls in the ultimate manage of that side is a question we would have to talk about at staff level. My overarching goal is the direction my commission provides me and how they want to do that is how I'm going to try and advocate for those fisheries when they're at least within our management arena. And so that would be, you know, we would advocate at our meetings for leaving fish uncaught at least as they left Oregon concurrent waters as a starting point. And, it, you know, but that's based on our current guidance. And so, you know, what the two commissions tell their respective staffs comes into play in terms of guidance for how we prosecute those things and how we resolve issues. If there's specifications for a certain strong approach from one commission or another, that obviously is going to bear some weight. So, but it does put the staffs in an awkward place.
Okay. Further questions? Well, okay. And if there's, are you ready to proceed, or you want to? Where does it? You want to wait till after lunch just to start the second part?
You've received our full presentation, so unless you have more to request from us, we're ready to let somebody else occupy these seats.
Okay. Yep. Then let's have. I don't think anybody will object to an early lunch. So we will break until 1:30.
Got it.
Yeah, true.
Just like you all remember in school, there are seats in the front. If anybody wants to, you guys stand alongside. Come on, there's seats up here. Don't. There's no grading. It's all right. All right, we will continue on with item number 3. So I will ask Bill and Ryan et al. To come back up. Not that Tucker and Chris are at and all. But,
and
thank you, Mr. Chair. I wasn't at all sure that we'd be able to have answers ready on several of those questions that you'd asked us that we weren't able to answer immediately during the question and answer session. And but I was informed by staff in the back that they'd already got a couple of them together, and then we met over lunch and worked through some of the rest of them. So we're prepared to provide some additional feedback on several of the questions that were asked that we weren't able to fully answer. And so with your leave, turn it over to Ryan, who I think has them ready on PowerPoint. And et and al will kick in as necessary, too.
So the first question we'll kind of come back to is one that Commissioner McIsaac was referring to on what the expected increase in the recreational angling trips would occur in the development of this policy with back in 2013 or back in 2012, and then how we played out when you compare to those numbers. So on the screen there, and this obviously is not in your handouts because we put this together at lunch, WDFW's decision document on page 97 reflects that answer, and that recreational angler trips in the transition period from 2013 through 16 are projected to increase by about 13% and in the long term by about 22% across spring Chinook, summer Chinook, and fall Chinook fisheries combined. So that's kind of what the expectations were. What we have here is the layout of what the increases were through the transitionary period. So that's 13 through 16. And you have a row for spring Chinook, summer Chinook, and fall Chinook. So we saw an increase in 10,000 trips for spring Chinook, a 6.1% increase from 13 through 16. And then if you carry over the 17, it would be 9.1% increase. So when you average it out, the increase is 4.1%. For summer Chinook, 3 to 7%, and fall Chinook, a little less than 2%. So when you go as a species, all those species combined, that comes out to about a 3% increase. So if you go back, the expected increase would be, you know, in the long term, 22%. Short term is approximately 3%. Then, unless
the next one.
Yes.
So, first of all, don't try and digest every single one of those little cells. So, as we were talking about some of the conversation about what the ocean looks like, among other things, this is one of the things that many of you have seen probably before. And this comes from NOAA's website on ocean indicators. And each of those rows represents a specific variable that NOAA has been measuring over some period of time that are somehow tied in particular to salmon ecology. You don't need to digest the guts and little pieces of it. It is online for anybody who wants to find it. If you just Google it, NOAA Ocean Indicators, you'll walk your way to this. They call it their stoplight table nowadays. And so there's things like copepod abundance, copepod species distribution, temperature measurements, sea surface temperature, a lot of the things you'll hear periodically as independent things. This sort of tries to roll them all together. And it's simple. Green is good, yellow is and red is not good. And that's within the range of time they've been measuring. And I think they use a frequency distribution of some sort to say it's in the lower portion if it's red, but I couldn't tell you where that break line is. And so it really is in context of the time period they've been measuring, and I can't see it up there, but my recollection, it was somewhere in the early 90s, it may be a little earlier. Even I can't see, well, especially I can't see that far. So within that context, though, you'll see a lot of red in recent years. And so that reflects a lot of the ocean condition things that we've been dealing with recently. You'll see a lot of green a few years back when we had some larger returns to the Columbia. NOAA's done some subsequent work to correlate these to Bonneville Dam returns. Some of you may have seen that as well. And so that's just sort of a general sense of a lot of indicators all at once. They do some global level rankings of sort of averaging all those things together. The next slide. I don't know if that's easily visible. Again, you don't need to get into the details too much, but that's a time series from left to right, right being most current, of the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, which is one of the metrics that's in that stoplight table. And it's an anomaly of temperatures in the northwest area. They measure it in a couple different places and in several different months, so I'm not sure which one this is. But the general take-home from this is when the temperatures are warmer than average, salmon survival tends to be lower. And so the dotted line, you'll see the bar charts that represent the measurement of PDO. The line itself is adult returns, I assume, to the Bonneville or Columbia mouth of salmon. I think Chinook in this case, not particularly relevant which one because it tends to work fairly well for most of them. So warm is not great for salmon. The more warm it is, the more not great, the less good it is. And negative value means it's cooler than average, which tends to be better. And so you'll see that essentially the high years of abundance tend to be associated with a negative PDO, a cool PDO. And you'll see that the last couple have been warm, not outrageously so, but warm. And so that is one of those lines that's in the red light, green light. Stoplight table, I don't know whether it's flagged red for this year or yellow for this year, but I'm sure it's not green. So we thought that might provide a little context to some of the questions, what to expect. These can be helpful in forecasting abundance. They're not perfect. None of the models are, but it's definitely something that's looked at every year coastwide nowadays, PFMC and others. This is local to our region, too, so this isn't a Gulf of Alaska type metric. It's a localized one. So,
excuse me. I left my Swarovskis at home.
Yes,
I can't quite read that. What's the timeline there on that?
I can't. What's the leftmost number for year?
Well, no, but let's go to the rightmost number. We in the 2015's where...
2018 or 17?
17.
The last, most current year on that graph, the farthest right is 17, I'm hearing from the back.
Okay.
So it's not yet available for 18.
It goes where it pegged out.
17.
What's the first year?
No. Back to where you were, Ryan.
17.
Oh, it's 1985 to 2017, though I understand that's not your question.
Yeah, go back
now.
To the right, right?
Oh, sorry.
There you go. Okay, where it's pegged up so high, that would have been like 14, 15, something like that, or what?
Oh, it would have been longer. Probably mid-90s.
Okay, so...
You're talking about the highest red bar?
Yes,
what's the highest red bar there, Ryan?
Highest line? 15.
No, highest red bar.
The highest warm PDO.
Yeah.
So the highest warm PDO number is 1999.
I'm still focused on the right.
So you're talking about the fish abundance.
We're in.
You're talking about the fish abundance line, the actual line, not the bars. Okay, my apologies.
It's
2015.
Okay.
Yeah. Sorry, I misunderstood you.
And then I also, so relevant to Commissioner Carpenter's other question about environmental conditions, this gives us a really good encapsulation of what's going on in the ocean when the smolts hit the ocean, and particularly in their early life history in the ocean. There is also, it's less well understood, but there is a connection between ocean conditions and on land conditions that then affect the Columbia River environment itself. And what we tend to see is that tough years in the ocean are also accompanied by tough years, often temperature-wise or flow-wise, in the river itself. And again, it's not as well understood. We don't have it in any sort of graphic, but there's tends to be a bad news goes with bad news kind of issue, particularly from the perspective of salmon. So back to Commissioner Carpenter's sort of other question about... what are we doing relative to being ready to address some of these stream temperature issues that we were talking about, and the suggestion that we think about a two-state essentially task force. We did talk about that a little bit over lunch, and certainly that's, I mean, we sort of see it in a couple ways. One is in terms of how we're going to get ready for 2019. Well, we're sort of already doing that, and we're already thinking about these things. We don't need to build something additional. We are, in essence, the thinking about 2019 task force. But over the longer term, we agree, thinking about issues, solutions like the one that Commissioner Kehoe suggested, thinking about in warmer than average years, being ready to buffer our escapement goals differently, applying those kinds of climate-related buffers or environmental condition-related buffers, that is worthy of some additional by-state time on that.
Yeah, Commissioner Carpenter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bill, one of the gentlemen in the audience caught me after when we went to lunch and asked me when I brought up the by-state task force scenario as far as the cold water refugia issue. He suggested that we include Idaho in that for obvious reasons, and that seemed to be logical, so I'll just put that out for your consideration.
Thanks. We will definitely check in with him and see if they're interested. That's a good idea. Appreciate that. So that covers the two that we had PowerPoint slides that we were able to pull together. Also wanted to return to a question about the differences between Oregon and Washington and our limited entry rules that Commissioner Baker asked. And as we discussed that question a little bit further, realized that we probably didn't get fully at what Commissioner Baker may have been interested in. So I'll offer a little bit of additional information and see if that helps you in terms of the question. The two states do have, as I said, different mechanisms for how we handle limited entry, but also some different rules about that, and there's probably a mismatch there as well. In Washington, if licenses are bought back, then they simply go away. Those bought back licenses go away under any conditions. Because of limited entry, we wouldn't have more. The remaining can still be sold and transferred and moved around, but under Washington rules, there's nothing else that would stop. So if we were, for instance, to take action in a buyback program to remove half of the Washington gillnet licenses, then from that point forward, unless there was additional action that the commission would take or authorize, or that the legislature would do, the remaining number of Washington gillnet licenses would be half of from where you started. It's a little different in Oregon.
In Oregon, it would function somewhat differently in that there's a floor on the number of commercial gillnet licenses available in the Columbia. So if it dropped below, I believe the number is 200 commercial licenses, then it would be opened back up to get that number back above 200
by rule, I believe.
Not clear if it's rule or statute.
Yeah, so I would have to check whether it's rule or statute or both. But
yes, Commissioner Baker.
Thank you for that. That clears things up quite a bit. Is there also a cap in Oregon?
Commissioner Baker, I don't believe there's a cap currently, but there is limited entry of no new issuance other than the floor rule. And so if it's currently, it's over 200, and so there's no issuance of new licenses. Assuming 200 is the right number, I think it is. Yeah. But and so, not a limit, but it's not more than it currently is by definition, unless it goes below that number. If that makes sense,
it does. And so the reason that I asked the question is because it appears, at least to me, that this difference between the two states complicates a buyback, at least in Washington, and I'm not sure about in Oregon. If I sold my license back and then wanted to cross the river and buy one in Oregon, at least it would be theoretically possible.
Commissioner, it would be possible to, a couple of things would be possible. One would be to purchase an existing license from somebody else.
Right.
If one was not available, it would not be possible to purchase another one unless the number had fallen below the 200 mark. And new permits were reissued at that point.
Okay, thank you. And just one more follow-up. How often is there that new issuance is capped? Is it normal? For instance, if I came today, could I buy a commercial gillnet license from you guys?
No, I think the number is well above 200 right now, and I don't believe we've, and Director Meltzer may know offhand, I don't believe we've issued a new, truly new, other than transfers, because it's a fair number above the 200 mark right now, so that's not an active consideration at the moment. It's just something that would be of interest in the future should that be pursued.
Thank you for
checking. That makes sense.
Also, I want to note that this kind of staff work over lunch is pretty incredible, and so appreciate all of you for that.
I think the thanks go to the crew in the back, so
yeah.
I'm sure they heard you. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Director Meltzer, did you want to comment on that?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. No, I would just concur and say that we have never issued new Columbia River gillnet permits since the limit entry became state law in, I believe, 1980. So there was initial issuance of about 1,000, I think it was, and over the ensuing 35 or 40 years, it's essentially been continuous attrition down to now about 300, plus or minus a few permit holders. We've never gone below the 200 level where the state law would currently require us to issue new permits.
And Bill, do you know how many we have? Or Ryan?
Upper 200s. I don't have an exact number. They have in the back.
Yeah, Cindy should have it. We've got the answer in the back. We can get that in just a second. And you want to run back? I wanted to point out one other functional difference or statutory difference between the two states. Washington's gillnet licenses in the lower Columbia are actually multi-area. It's either Columbia/Willapa or Columbia/Grays Harbor licenses. And Oregon's are strictly Columbia. So a license right now may not be actively participating in the Columbia. Maybe, for instance, only participating in Willapa, but it could at any point become an active Columbia license again. And that's a different constraint than Oregon has to deal with.
And I just got the number in the back. Currently, we have 249 licenses within Washington.
Thank you. Chair Finley?
point of interest, it was a question of mine. It was prompted by the Idaho question. I fished several times in British Columbia on the Upper Columbia near Windermere Lake where it exits. Are there any programs that you have, or I understand the latitude and the different differences with BC, are there any programs related to thermal or other projects that you cooperate with as a state of Washington?
The only river that has salmon that reaches into Canada is the Okanagan right now. The Columbia, as you're aware, falls into the formerly category. Yeah. And within the Okanagan, we've actually had an increasing focus on temperature because it's a temperature-challenged watershed. And we've worked very closely. Washington State, the province, as well as the federal government, the First Nations, and then the Colville tribes have all worked pretty closely on managing temperature in the Okanagan watershed, tried to make some, and successfully have made some adaptations to the Okanagan to increase the ability of salmon to persist in that watershed, even under warmer water. We've still got a lot to do. Our primary target is to gain sockeye, in particular, access into a couple of the larger lakes that fall entirely on the Canadian side of the border, because they offer a lot more cold water refuge for sockeye than currently Osuyas Lake is the only lake that's really open to them. So pretty productive working relationship, but everything takes time. And unless the commissioners have any further questions, I think that's it for us on follow-up.
Any further questions? Thank you. And Commissioner McIsaac, you wanted to follow up with something else?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And where do we go from here kind of is the question. So let me start by saying thanks to the staff for their excellent work on this over the course of the past many months and then leading up to today. We've reviewed the policy performance, and we've got a nice listing here in our briefing materials on areas of policy and regulatory concurrence and non-concurrence. So returning to Commissioner Atkinson's question of this morning, if we have as a mutual goal concurrence at the policy and regulatory level, where do we go from here? And so maybe I would just offer a few thoughts to maybe kick off the discussion here. It seems like there's two pathways that we ought to take a look at. One is the immediate pathway. What about concurrent business in 2019? That might be a simpler situation than the bigger question, which is the other pathway. What about concurrency in policy and regulation matters maybe over the next 5 years? In other words, are there any adjustments in the plan that ought to take place on a longer-term permanent basis? We got a big list of ideas here that deserve some attention in the long run. But on the first part, what do we do about concurrence in 2019? And it seems like there might be three different models out there for the commissioners here at the front table to think about and trying to come up with some solution by February or March so that it would be in play during fisheries in 2019. One might be to just delegate to the directors to take a look at this and do the best they can and try to get to concurrent regulations, and please come back in February or March with a set of concurrent regulations. And I'm not particularly in favor of that alternative because I think it just puts too much pressure on our directors, and the responsibility here is at the front table for these difficult decisions. Another alternative would be that each commission go back and think about this on their own, do their own staff work, and come back together for a joint meeting like this in February or March and try to do the best they can to reach concurrency. The other model, which might be more similar to what has been done in the past, is to have a joint group of commissioners, maybe three from each state, work on a recommendation to their respective commissions over the course of the next couple of months, and come back in February or March for another joint meeting where those recommendations are discussed by all the commissioners, and come to some resolution about what to do in 2019. And having thought about this, I'm more in favor of this latter alternative. I don't think we ought to try to appoint commissioners here today. Each commission can go home and do that kind of a thing. I think that if this group of three commissioners each met two or three or four times over the course of the winter and wrestled with the idea of concurrency and tried to come up with some recommendations, that might be a good thing. I think those meetings ought to be open to the public. We've done some experimenting in Washington with open committee meetings and closed committee meetings, and we've had some pretty good success with open committee meetings, showing the kind of transparency that I think a lot of people expect out of good governance. It has been up to the chairman whether or not public comment is taken at these open committee meetings, and I don't think there ought to be any expectation from the public that there be public comment at those meetings. Their time to comment would be when the full commissions make decisions. But by being a public, by being an open meeting, it would allow other commissioners who aren't in the group of three to attend and listen and understand and learn. And while they would not be able to participate in the vote of their three commissioners as to what a recommendation would be, having them be open meetings allows not only the public but also the other commissioners the opportunity to be there and hear all the dialogue necessary. So that's just some thoughts of mine to start things off.
Thank you. And we will not be making any decisions today according to our agenda. So any thoughts from Oregon on Commissioner McIsaac's thought? Yes, Commissioner Atkinson.
I really like that idea. I think that to have representation from both states to work together with ideas it will really be beneficial to help us with concurrency where it's a joint decision. Certainly, we each still have our own autonomy, but I think just the discussion of maybe ruling some things out we none of us want to change and other areas we see that we have more commonality, I think it'll improve the process of coming to concurrency and improving our policy.
So maybe both commissions will take the recommendation of that back to our subsequent next commission meeting and then be in communication. But, okay. Yes, Commissioner Baker.
Commissioner McIsaac, when we were both new, that there might be times when we disagree, and this could be one of them. Only that I want to throw out a nuance or a slightly more complicated version of his suggestion, and that is that we have spent quite a bit of time as a commission lamenting the amount of work that this is and the amount of diving into the weeds and sort of micromanaging that we're required to do. And what seems to happen often is that we all really want to be in on the details, on the things that we know the best, and maybe the things that we don't. And maybe that's the reason that I think there's a hybrid here, because this is not my expertise. But we are sitting in a room full of people who are expert at this, and I, like I said, I'm very, very impressed with the staff presentations and with our directors. What I think we might at least consider is a situation where we get together with our commissions and hopefully can exchange some paper on giving our director very clear direction about what we would like them to look at in the near term, and the I hate to say slant, but the things that we want to make sure are incorporated and considered, we let them go back and let our staffs work, who obviously have the relationships and the knowledge with each other, work together to come up with something to bring it back to us, and then we meet as a commission, as a joint commission, again, to consider it and to see if it's if they were able to come to something that would meet our needs. This, to me, requires us to, as individual commissions, come up with some principles, and they would be, need to be really sincere. For instance, one of mine, obviously, we're all into conservation. We all need to think about the fact that it really makes very little sense to try to manage a river with two sets of rules. So concurrency is a high value. And beyond that, this last discussion that we've had about the temperature of the water is a lot of that's new to me, and so we also have to be able to plan in the future for contingencies that adaptive management may or may not be able to take care of. So my position would be slightly different. It would be to give clear direction to the directors about what we want looked at for 2019. This is trying to get something done quick, what the what our principles and objectives are, what we don't want, and then let them come back and then meet again. Possibly in between there could be a meeting. I like the idea of having a subset of each of us also in discussion. So that could work too. But thinking that we have about from now till March probably, I'm not sure that the two commissions could get the job done for 2019.
I think that adds option number four to the scenario that we can bring up at our, put that on the agenda for the next commission meeting and then relay. And likewise for you. Yes.
I just wanted to say I have a concern about delaying on this process. Partly, I guess, my own personal reason is that I'm going to be off the commission after next summer. And with our commission, the people that have been involved from the start of this are all going to be going off commission in the next year and a half. And so I feel it's important for us to address it while we have a somewhat similar commission that we have right now, because in 2 years, only one person on this commission will still be part of the commission. So we will have all new people. And I'm concerned that with the complexity of this topic, we're better to deal with it while we have a contingent of commissioners on both sides that have the background knowledge to make that decision.
I think we could come up, our next meeting in December, we could come up with the plan then to get underway. I mean, we can digest that in between that and then get back then. Yes.
So, Commissioner Baker, speaking to the plan to come up with something for 2019, and I think Commissioner Atkinson's talking about coming up with a plan for the long run. So if I understand Commissioner Baker's proposal here, it would not include any committees. Is that how I understand it? If that's true, then we would have to deal with, well, what do you do about the long run? And if we wanted to wrestle with all these tough issues and try to conclude that by midsummer of 2019, then what's the mechanism to do that? Is that joint commission-to-commission meetings or something else? And so, I would agree with Commissioner Baker that tasking the directors to come up with some solid analysis that will feed into the process is a good idea. Whether that feeds into a subcommittee, a committee-type arrangement, or feeds into direct commission-to-commission deliberations with no committee meetings seems to be the question. And why I end up favoring the committee thing is because there is a lot more time that can be spent at a committee level, and it's much more difficult to get the entire commissions together for joint meetings to wrestle all these things out. So I see the committee process better for the long run, certainly. to have multiple face-to-face full commission joint meetings seems a real legitimate challenge. But I also think because of the time involved, and if it is indeed open to all commissioners to come to these committee meetings, whoever are willing, that we can maybe attain the kind of, I presume, attain the kind of full awareness of all the commissioners that Commissioner Baker's after.
Yes.
Thank you. Those are really good points, Commissioner Atkinson. I had no idea that you all were going to have such a large turnover. And at least speaking for our commission, as a new member, there is a lot of, you know, I'm learning from other commissioners. And so that's a very good point. I understand that we are not supposed to make any decisions today. But the question about the lag in decision-making is also a very good point. So what I think what I'd like to do is have us spend some time today and tomorrow, and we're going to be here for a couple of days, and maybe at least for the Washington Commission have a proposal, at least think about trying to have a proposal for the Oregon Commission by the end of the weekend. And maybe we won't have to lag for a month.
I would concur with that. Other thoughts? Commissioner Carpenter.
I don't think it's possible. I mean, I understand what you said, Commissioner Baker. I think we could have the first cut at it over the next couple of days with perhaps a follow-up conference call in order to get it more solid, I guess. I'll just put that out.
And I read that's what you meant by the first cut, not a final. Yes,
Commissioner. On the matter of no decisions being made today, I think for those that were involved in the planning meeting for this, it was that there'd be no decisions on particulars today, no decisions on ideas for change, no decisions on adjustments, no motions to be made I think this ought to be this or that for the commercial fishery or the sport fishery. But it was not no decisions on what the process would be to move forward and try to get to some sort of concurrency. But I'd open it up to others that were involved in that original discussion. I think we do need to leave here today with an idea of a process by which we get to concurrency. If you want to call that a mini decision instead of a decision, maybe there's that distinction. But in the planning for this, it was not that there would be no decisions of any sort made. It was no decision on the list of ideas.
And I would, thanks, Chair. I would like to speak in favor of Mr. McIsaac's suggestion. Due to the fact about truly what job descriptions are around here, if we defer it to staff, they have a pretty tight criterion which they can deal with. And with us, we're supposed to be looking over the horizon, looking at opportunities, looking at different perspectives. You know, it almost gets to the point that you got to look at a six-year-old to learn something, but they're always asking why, and exploring new things. And I think that should be part of our job, is to do that. And with the commission, they have a lot more freedom to explore different ideas. Then there again, probably have to take them back to the staff, will this float or not? But I think it's a big, big opportunity. And it's really easy for me to say because I'm a long ways away. I probably won't get in on it. But if we had people on the commission willing to serve, I would think it'd be fantastic.
Done this two ways, both as a more or less committee of the whole and then a very small negotiating committee. I think it was two or three of us. Sometimes the discussions reveal thoughts or opportunities or omissions that the other members of the commission don't see. Today's a perfect example. We're hearing thoughts and ideas and from each other. If we did a small committee, I would think that that's only the backbone. That those two or three men and women are obligated to be the structure, but that every other commissioner on either side that's able to attend any meeting doesn't attend it as an observer, attends it as a committee member so that they can contribute and listen. And then when it comes to a vote, they all are using the same information. So that's the nuance that I would offer.
Well, let me ask one thing. Council, are you out
here? He's back here.
Oh, there. In the realm of decision making, are we in safe havens or out in the wild seas?
I think for the state of Washington, I mean, you can talk about policy and creating a schedule of things and a committee. I'm not sure it's as much an issue for Washington. I don't know whether it's an issue for Oregon. But identifying a path to go forward is appropriate, sure.
Okay. I like that phrasing, a path to go forward. That is not a decision. So do we want to entertain then a path to go forward? Any objections to that? Seeing none, okay, we will identify a path to go forward. Now, what path do we take?
We could do this during meeting planning.
Sure. We'll do it on meeting planning. Think it through, and then on Saturday, we'll do it on meeting planning. Okay. Yeah.
That works well for us, and that works well for my suggestion that we try as hard as we can to come up with a workable proposal for Oregon, but that doesn't include any of Oregon's thoughts in the path forward if they want to give them. So I guess... I guess I'd like to know what you all think of this process so far. Does this work for you? That we think about it and send you one way or another our ideas?
Commissioners, comments? Thoughts?
I will open it up.
Commissioner Akinson.
You know, it doesn't really work that well that way. I think that's what the last model was who guys voted, and... it limited our opportunity to weigh in on options. So I believe that the first step should be a joint group, or you present to us some ideas you have, and we present to you ideas we have, and then we look at them together. But I think it's essential that we do it together piece. Otherwise, one state or the other is basically just following the model of the other state. So I don't know, I'm not opposed to when that group time is, but I think it's essential that we at some point look at it together. I don't think it's a bad idea for you to come up with some ideas and for us to come up with ideas, and they may not match, but that's the point where we get together and see where our agreements are.
I think that's what we were thinking, not that this was a fait accompli.
Chair, were you imagining that we would have a smaller group meeting together between the states and then bringing their recommendations back to the combined commissions for discussion and a vote at that point? Are we going to decide together? We're going to be able to debate, ask questions of your subgroup, you asking questions of our subgroup? Is that, I'm a little curious on how it's functioning.
Yes.
I'm afraid we're kind of talking past one another, because I think our discussion was on Saturday, we're just going to come up with a plan of how we want to work with you and tell you that we're talking about process over here. We're not talking about any.
Well, I'm talking about process too, but you're talking about your first step. Yeah. Do you even want to have a smaller group?
Yeah, exactly.
That's what you're going to do.
Yeah.
Well, then we really don't have a say in that.
Vote on theirs.
First, we need to agree that Saturday is Saturday. So
that's awesome.
Yeah. But Sunday you have an extra hour.
Up to that.
Okay. Let's move on then. Good. We will ruminate and then discuss on Saturday. Samtag.